For the week of July 29th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 156, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the Olympic Village, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're still in the Olympic Village.
Sadly, no, I'm not. My sister has been going to the games. She lives in London, so she's been sending photos from like badminton and volleyball and gymnastics when she's, you know, been in this venue or that venue. So I feel like I'm at the Olympics, but I'm actually not there.
Have you yelled at her yet for ruining any of the results before you get to watch them on television?
Oh, my friend Pete did that for me. I was at the Yankee game, taping, of course, DVR in the Olympics. I love the Summer Olympics even more. I like the Olympics in general, but the Summer Olympics I really like. A lot more events that I care about than the Winter Olympics. And I was taping events, and then my friend Pete told me what happened in the men's swim-off between, Phelps and Lochte. So that was nice. Not only did he tell me Phelps didn't win, he told me that Lochte did. So it was a double blow there.
Spoiler alert, yes, just in case somebody hasn't.
4 days ago, and yeah. It's too late. You get a day and then you're done. The British medaled. The British medaled in gymnastics. You know, sorry. It happened last night. If you don't know by now, it's your fault.
Well, we don't have a guest on this week's show because I was, too lazy, I think the word is. It's summertime. I didn't book one. But on today's show, we will be discussing the Olympics. They began last week, as Michael said, in London. And television coverage is breaking all sorts of records. Here in the United States, NBC's coverage has gotten a lot of flack for being, well, I guess not exactly live, as Michael and I were just saying. We'll also discuss the aftershock in Hollywood over the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting during the opening of Dark Knight Rises, during that midnight screening. Spotify and Netflix released some subscriber numbers last week, so we can fill you in on all of that news and all of those figures. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is The Dark Knight Rises, which opened wider overseas. It grossed $186 million worldwide. It's over $500 million. $537 million and counting after its second weekend, and we'll have to see where it goes from here. Of course, we'll never know how all these films were affected by the shooting. We'll have a little more about that in a minute, about depressed ticket sales this Friday, and then people started coming back to the theater on Saturday. But, you know, as far as The Dark Knight Rises is concerned, we can compare it to the other movies, and right now it's doing pretty good. You know, $500 million is nothing to sneeze at, but it should reach at least $1 billion or it will be considered a disappointment, something that was depressed by the tragedy.
Yeah, you know, people are saying, oh, it's running behind The Dark Knight in terms of like where The Dark Knight was after 10 days in release. You know, it had earned more money than The Dark Knight Rises. A couple points. One, it's the third in a trilogy. Two, it's incredibly hard to get in to see some of these IMAX screenings in large cities. And three, you had this huge horrific shooting. So, you know, the third point there, who knows how that affects ticket grosses, but that's the
and
least of their worries.
And four is the Olympics. The Olympics always depress box office, and they're proving a huge hit Nielsen ratings-wise. A lot of people are watching the Olympics, so we'll get that into that a little bit more when we talk about the Olympics in depth, but that's a big factor for every movie out right now.
Good point.
At number two around the world is Ice Age Continental Drift. It grossed another $62 million worldwide. It's at $629 million and counting.
Boy, you see $629 million, and you can understand why they've made four of those movies.
Right. They're not wildly expensive animated films. Some are. They can cost $200 million. The Ice Age films are kept, they're done on a dime. And so it's a very profitable series.
Yeah, you never hear like Ray Romano gets $25 million for next Ice Age movie.
Well, it's hard to get, they used to say, oh, you should just be privileged to do voiceover work for animated films. That was Disney's pitch. No, you should just be happy. Your kids get to see a movie you made. You know, don't complain. Why do you want any money? Then people realized they were making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars hand over fist and finally said, you know what? Actually, I'd like some money for that movie.
Right.
And nowadays, they're certainly getting more money. Certainly not what they might get for a live action movie. But Ray Romano probably gets more for Ice Age than he has for any other movie he's made. You know, he's a huge TV star, obviously. He's made one huge hit, one well-reviewed TV series, and, he's a big fixture there. But in movies, he's certainly not a draw.
No, not at all.
At number three around the world is The Amazing Spider-Man, which grossed another $19 million worldwide. I'm a little confused as to where it is in its overseas campaign, but worldwide, we know it has made $654 million, and the first three films in the series all made around $800 million. So if this one can get to $800 million, it will be on par with the other Spider-Man movies, not counting for inflation, Sperling.
Okay.
At number four around the world is Step Up Revolution, the fourth film in the dance series. It grossed $17 million worldwide. That includes a pretty weak North American debut of $11.8 million, which people said, oh my gosh, the series is over. It's dead. Finally, we won't have to see any more Step Up movies. But they're wrong, because we follow the worldwide box office and you listen to us and you're smart. You know that the worldwide box office is really what matters. And this is a great example of it, the Step Up series. In North America, the movies have declined every film. The first one grossed $65 million, the second one $58 million, the third one $43 million. And it's a possibility this one will gross even less than that. But overseas, the first one grossed $50 million, the second one grossed $90 million, and the third one grossed $120 million. So overall, each movie has made more money than the one before. They're very cheap to make. Will there be a Step Up 5? You bet there will be. At number five around the world is The Thieves, a South Korean film. It's a crime thriller about a gang of robbers loose in Macau. Macau is the gambling region connected to China.
Hong Kong, yeah.
Well, China, really.
Yeah.
It grossed $16 million in its debut. And this is a point where we want to remind you, we get as much information as we can, but we're beholden to the people who send it to us and post it online and share it with the world. We get a very good record of what Hollywood movies make worldwide, which didn't used to happen even 5 years ago. But nowadays, we really know what something like Spider-Man or Dark Knight makes around the world. But movies in different countries like Bollywood films or the South Korean film or that Japanese series we'll get to in a minute about the Coast Guard, we really, it sort of catches catch can. So our numbers here are as good as we can get based on all the sources that we pull from. In a better world, we would have pure access to the debuts in Bollywood and South Korea and Japan and France. We know the grosses in every country around the world and be able to give you really accurate numbers. But, you know, we take what we can and we give you the best list we can. Just put an asterisk by every box office that we give you. Know that the Hollywood movies are really well tracked. Films in other countries,
not so much.
It comes to us only when they're really a big hit like this. Somebody bothered to mention to it, maybe someone who has optioned it for North American remake rights, or they're going to release it in the U.S., something like that. This is a big hit. Variety or Hollywood Reporter had to pay attention to it. $16 million. That's a big, big debut in South Korea. And South Korea culturally is really a really big force in Asia. They really, their TV shows,
especially when
movies.
It comes to, yeah, when it comes to movie going and certainly K-pop, you know, the music. Yeah.
They are a driving force in Asia. And of course, that's a massive, massive market. So that's the number five film around the world. Number six, Brave, the Pixar film. That grossed another $14 million worldwide. It's at $309 million and counting. And number seven is a debut, The Watch, the Ben Stiller, Vince Vaughn comedy. It grossed $13 million in North America. A disappointment. It got hit every way to Sunday. There were other bigger movies. The trailer's not very funny. They got sideswiped by the Trayvon Martin tragedy.
In Florida.
And the fact that their movie is based on a neighborhood watch group shooting at people. You know, it just, everything that could go wrong with this movie, including the fact that it didn't get good reviews, sort of, you know, knocked this one in the knees. Plus, of course, there are the Olympics. And number eight around the world is Ted, the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie. Another $10 million. That's at $237 million and counting. And number nine is Madagascar 3, another hit animated series that grossed $7 million. It just passed the $500 million mark. And number 10, an animated film we haven't heard about for a while, The Lorax, opened in a few more countries. So it has now grossed $5.7 million this weekend. That's at $324 million worldwide and counting. And then number 11, the last film on our list, Umizaru 4. That's the Japanese, I'm sorry, it's another South Korean film. It's about the Coast Guard. It's the fourth in a series. It grossed another $5 million this weekend. It's at $48 million and counting. So those are the movies this weekend that came out last week. Next week, we can look forward to Total Recall will be coming out this week. That's the remake of the Arnold Schwarzenegger film.
Which looks pretty good. Looks kind of interesting.
Well, I think it's sweet that someone still thinks Colin Farrell is a leading man. It's just sweet. The original opened at $25 million back in 1990. This one certainly better do better than that if it hopes to be a hit. Also coming out is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, the third in the series. They're cheap, low-budget movies, and they make their money. And in limited release, another Andy Samberg film. This one is a drama called Celeste and Jesse Forever. It's about a divorced couple who try to remain friends. He's still trying to prove that leaving Saturday Night Live was not a bad idea.
And this is just in North America, of course. This is not around the world.
Oh, thank you very much. That's true. We could go country by country, but that would make our podcast 4 hours long.
Right. And then people would actually turn it off after 10 minutes. So
I just figured, you know, we come out in the middle of the week by the time we record it and get the information and edit it and get it out online to the world. It's usually Wednesday or Thursday before people get to listen. So they're kind of looking ahead to next weekend.
Right. Well, you know, so is a group like Harvey Weinstein, who, of course, runs the Weinstein Company and ran Miramax for years. You know, he, I guess, look, the guy's released some really violent movies. He released Pulp Fiction, for Pete's sake, and some of Martin Scorsese movies like Gangs of New York. Now he's saying, you know, based on this Dark Knight Rising shooting in Aurora, Colorado, he'd like to have a filmmaker summit on violence in movies.
Can you cue the audio for crickets? That was the reaction of everybody in Hollywood to this suggestion. He said, we should have a summit about violence in movies. Of course, the real problem is guns, but we should still have a summit anyway. It was just a moronic, stupid comment by him. What would they do? They'd get together and say, yeah, you know, some movies are violent. And they'd all say, well, those are the artistic ones. We don't make gratuitous violence.
Right.
So, okay, let's go home.
You know, Peter Bogdanovich last week said, you know, that violence in film is out of control, quote unquote. But, you know, I was a little kind of not shocked, but I was like, why is he saying anything? He has nothing to do with this story and he should just stay away from it.
Well, I think it's because of his film Target, which was one of his first film that he was involved in before The Last Picture Show, one of the great movies of all time, by the way. He had three just brilliant movies in a row. But before them, he had Target, which was starred Boris Karloff and was about an old-time movie guy. And this person became obsessed with old movies and ended up in the end of the movie shooting people at a drive-in movie theater.
I remember that movie.
So, you know, that was the tie-in. Somebody just called him on the phone and he went rambling on. And then they transcribed it and turned it into an essay or a piece for The Hollywood Reporter. He said he wasn't very articulate. He was just angry. And I would agree with him. He was very inarticulate.
Well, no, I was talking about Harvey Weinstein, not Peter Bogdanovich. I don't know how Harvey Weinstein is getting involved in any of this. He should just
because he's, you know, he's just trying to look like a responsible Hollywood mogul.
Well, Warner Brothers is trying to be responsible. They have this movie, Gangster Squad. You already talked about The Watch, which was initially called Neighborhood Watch, and Ben Stiller stars in it with
Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn, and he was what's his name? He was nominated
Jonah
for
Jonah Hill.
Thank you. Oh, I was stumbling over my words there, and I could not.
And the guy from the IT Crowd, I think.
Yes, and I guess they had to delay the film. They then had to change the name, and in the end, as you said, it didn't do very well at all. Of course, they had to change the name because of the shooting in Florida of a neighborhood watch captain, I suppose, shot in an unarmed teenager. Well, in this case, the Dark Knight Rises shooting has caused Warner Brothers to go back and, first off, delay the opening of Gangster Squad, which is one of their films, and they're going to do some reshoots. They delayed it until January 11th, and they're going to reshoot a key action scene, which it was a major shootout at Grauman's Chinese Theater, the kind of renowned movie palace from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and it is still a movie palace today. And I guess the villains came roaring from behind the silver screen with their guns blazing, and that was in the trailer, so they're going to change that scene.
Right, it's a big scene in the movie. This is a period film about fighting gangsters in L.A., and it's a period piece, a lot of young, sexy stars like Ryan Gosling. It was just going to come out in a few weeks, and they said, first of all, they said, all right, we got to push the delay. Do we just leave that scene in, even though it's a big, you know, central scene in the movie, or do we reshoot it? And they've decided to reshoot it. They just feel like it's just too close to the bone right now, and it just doesn't help. If you saw that earlier trailer, they come pouring through the screen, literally out towards the audience, Tommy guns blazing. So it was just, you know, a wildly unfortunate coincidence. They're not being responsible in the sense of trying to do what's right for the community. They're being responsible to the film and their stockholders and saying, this is not a good time to release this film, which I agree with.
Well, we should move on to television news, and let me tease you what we're going to talk about. Guess what? We're going to talk about the Olympics. But before we talk about the Olympics and how it's being covered by the different networks, let me tell you that, you know, we actually have a Twitter account and a Facebook page, and we'd love for you to follow us or to like us on Facebook. On Facebook, our username is ShowbizSandbox, and our username on Twitter is ShowbizSandbox. So please come and follow us.
Well, certainly if you watch the Olympics, you can see that every once in a while they love social media. They have a social media reporter who says this athlete has, you know, 300,000 followers and this event got, you know, this many tweets and stuff like that. So they try to be hip and cool by doing social media. We just want to see the sports.
Yeah, the problem with social media for them is that the Olympics take place in one time zone and everywhere else it's either, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or it's delayed until prime time.
Well, I don't think it's a problem at all. I mean, how could you have it take place at the same time zone for everyone in the world?
Obviously, you can't. So,
right. I think it's a perfectly thing. We know that if an Olympic is in a good time zone for the major networks in the U.S., that means it's more valuable. So if you're like 10 hours ahead, that's kind of too far away and it makes your Olympics less valuable. So the major networks pay less money for that Olympics based on what country it's in. If it's in the same time zone or based in North America, then it's a lot more money because, you know, everything can be more live. So, you know, that raises and lowers the value of what different countries pay for the Olympics. It's perfectly natural. And NBC, I don't think they've really gotten a lot of flack. There's some news media saying, why aren't they showing some events live? Well, duh, because they paid $1 billion for the Olympics and they want to show the big events in prime time. Of course they're going to do that. But if you're at all technologically minded, they stream like 20 or 30 different events live online.
I know, it's way too much. I mean, there's no way to watch it all. That's for sure.
Well, and you couldn't watch all the Olympics, period.
Yes.
But the fact is, if you want to, you can go online and watch any event you want live. So there you go. What are you complaining about?
Well, I think they're I'm not
everything.
Complaining.
They've got five channels. They've got NBC, MSNBC, CNBC, Bravo, and I think the NBC Sports. They're showing more coverage of more events, you know, than you could ever have seen before in history. Plus, if you're really desperate and don't want to wait 4 hours and avoid the websites for a little while, just so you don't get spoiled about the winners, you can go watch the swimming or the gymnastics or archery or badminton or whatever they have available online live. So, good God, why would anybody complain? They're doing everything they can to make it available to you any way you want.
Yeah, I mean, in 1996, when the games were in Atlanta, they broadcast about
80 gazillion hours.
No, 190 hours of Olympics coverage. This year, they have 5,300 hours of
and the 190 coverage. Hours made people's heads spin. We were like, oh, my God.
Enough with the coverage. Yeah. They
No, I wouldn't say that at all. You know, there are fans of that woman who just won a shooting medal for the fifth Olympic in a row. It's an amazing feat. The first North U.S. athlete to do in history. And she won another gold in, I think it was skeet shooting. I forget the discipline she was in. But, you know, hey. There are people who care only about ski. I love wrestling. They don't show a lot of wrestling. I love, you know, I love gymnastics and swimming and diving. So a lot of that is in prime time. But there are some events I love that don't get a lot of coverage. And I love the fact that if I choose my favorite event, I can go catch it somewhere. That's
and you really have
terrific.
To be careful about checking your email or checking Twitter because, and I think the Los Angeles Times finally figured it out. Instead of actually saying what occurred
right.
in the headline.
Click here for the latest. Exactly.
They say, you know, swimming, male swimming, you know, 200 breaststroke results.
And, right, exactly.
And because they were saying, you know, Phelps loses, you know, or Phelps wins. And people were like, great, I wasn't going to open that email so that I didn't ruin my, you know, watching them this evening, the Olympics this evening. Now I know what happened. So they've actually gotten a little bit smarter, probably because people were complaining. NBC has really only been criticized for not live streaming one event in particular, which was the opening ceremony. They didn't live stream that.
Did they have the rights to do that or?
They did. And they actually said specifically, we're not doing that because the opening ceremony needs context. You need to have somebody explaining to you what's going on and what, who's who. And
you wouldn't enjoy it as much unless we give it to you.
Right. But really, the reality
is they want as high ratings as possible.
Right. They didn't want a whole bunch of people sitting there watching it during the day on their computers and then not watching it at night. They need those ratings. And they were record ratings.
That's right. I get they kept saying it was the highest Summer Olympics. First, they said non-US and then they said overall. So it beat the 96 Atlanta Games. It had 40 million viewers. And I guess it's I guess it's higher than even any Winter Olympic ceremony. I haven't gotten any figures, but as far as I can tell, the way they phrased it, it sounded like they were making a caveat. But no, it seems to be the highest of all time rated opening ceremony on North American television. 40 million viewers. And the numbers have stayed steady. On Saturday night, they had 28 million viewers. Sunday night, 35 million. Monday night, 31 million. So, you know, they're pulling terrific ratings. And the funny thing is, though, they spent so much money that the report is, well, gee, they're doing so well, they might actually break even.
Right, exactly. You know, I tried to get the European ratings for this particular, for the Olympics. I couldn't find them anywhere.
Well, the UK was the highest rated event of the year in the UK, the opening ceremony. So, you know, there have been scattered ratings that you can catch, you know, obviously UK matter because they were the host country. So that's why it was mentioned. But, you know, you can, I'm sure if you lived in Spain and read the papers, you could see that stuff. I just went to the New York Times to see if the websites had gotten smarter because I was avoiding the New York Times or any other website during the day because they'll splash the news rather than saying latest Olympic updates and letting you click on it and then see the news, you know, which is what they should do. They, of course, I go to the front page and I have a spoiler about the swimming.
Right.
So I already know something that happened tonight. Thanks a lot, New York Times. You know, sometimes you want to wait and watch it on television. But there you go.
Well, and you mentioned that NBC might break even. That, of course, NBC owns the rights for North America here in the, or at least just the United States, maybe, they own the rights for. They sold $1 billion in advertising for the Olympics.
Were there any other criticisms of NBC? I thought that was, you know, silly, the delaying of prime time. I thought with all the options you have and all the amount of programming, I thought that was just, you know, I thought they're doing just fine. I think they're doing everything they can, basically. They also had some criticism in the opening ceremony for cutting away from a tribute to the victims of a terrorist attack in the UK. You know, it's a four and a half hour event, you know.
They had a July 7th tribute that was, I think, 7 minutes long, and they cut away from that and they didn't show that. That's, you're right.
Yeah, they said, well, we felt that wasn't as germane to U.S. audiences. And right. Kind of a downer. We did get to see the tribute to National Health, however.
That's true. And we did get to see Tim Berners-Lee tweet from the middle of the stadium, and nobody knew what the heck was going on.
Tim Berners-Lee, of course, is one of the people integral in creating the internet. Should we say the internet or the World Wide Web?
It's the World Wide Web, actually.
It's the World Wide Web. Thank you very much. The difference between the World Wide Web and the internet?
Oh, please don't do this to me.
Okay, sorry. Never mind. the opening ceremony was daft, as all opening ceremonies are. The only one that's actually been good is the Beijing Olympics. All my life, they're kind of boring. I never really enjoy them. It takes 4 hours for the athletes to walk around the stadium. They're always a silly melange of things. Sometimes a good singer comes out and does a song. Sometimes there's some good visual effect. But it's essentially just a silly, messy, crazy, nutty, dull, goofy thing. It's goofy. It's like Eurovision. You know, it's the Eurovision of sports. I thought Danny Boyle's, there were some good moments, but overall, it's as silly and goofy as they all are, except for Beijing. Some bizarre song choices, but I was surprised at how good the reviews were for it.
Yeah, so was I. I mean, I kind of felt bad for Danny Boyle, because how do you compare to Beijing just 4 years ago? I mean, I think every opening ceremony will now be compared to Beijing. That was just...
And fall short.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how, unless you have a billion people where you can like take 20,000 of them and make them turn them into robots to, you know, jump around in your opening ceremony. I don't know how you top that. It was amazing.
I guess it proves that Danny Boyle is not as good a director as Zhang Yimou.
I don't know about that.
It's absolutely true. Zhang Yimou is a much better director. He's like five or six great, great films to his credit. Danny Boyle has like 2.5.
Which are?
You know, not even Slumdog Millionaires. I don't think that's a particularly good film. I think it's okay. You know, Trainspotting is his big film.
Yes, I would say Trainspotting is a classic. Shallow Grave.
That's a fun B movie. I liked it. I interviewed him for it.
Yeah.
But it's not a great movie. It's a good movie. It introduced his talent. He topped it with Trainspotting. And ever since then, he's had sort of melange of sort of sometimes interesting, not great movies. The most popular, of course, of which is Slumdog Millionaires, which is a good movie, not a great movie, and won the Oscar and was a big success. But, you know, A Life Less Ordinary and all the other movies he's made, and they're not that good. Zhang Yimou is a world-class director. When he was made at his peak, he made 5, 6, 7 movies that were good to absolutely stunningly great, I think.
What about Millions? Millions was a good movie.
Well, it's okay.
Okay, 28 Days Later.
That's his other good movie. Thank you. That's his other really good movie. Okay. That's a terrific genre film. Very clever movie. It would have been on my best of the year list for that year, along with Trainspotting for its year. So those are the two films of his I think are the most important.
Ah, okay. Well, I mean, I thought it was okay. I mean, I totally agree with you. Watching all the athletes walk in could not be more boring. And that's like 2.5 to 3 hours of the whole opening ceremony. So
there you go. Otherwise, yeah. I'm enjoying the Olympics. I saw all the empty seats in the at some events. It always drives me nuts.
I told people to stay away. I said, look, it's going to be really crowded. Try to stay away if you can. And I'm glad to see that you know, the audiences and the fans in the UK are listening to us.
My friend Noam called it. He said, you know what? It's all the seats for the fat cats.
Yeah.
And he was right. The Guardian in the UK did a story because on television, you could see hundreds and sometimes 1,000 or more empty seats are like gymnastics. And we've been told every event is sold out. And you have all these empty seats. And they're like, well, we've looked into it. It looks like these are seats reserved for members of the Olympic family, like governing bodies and athletes and officials. And I assume the advertisers and corporations that are linked to the Olympics. You can imagine the demand for comp tickets is overwhelming from all the massive multinational corporations and people that are involved in these games.
Absolutely.
You've got a ton of people who are going to demand stuff at the drop of a hat. You got to be prepared. And yet it looks terrible to have empty seats there.
There's a way to actually combat that. And that is, you know, of course, I agree with you. You're going to have all these sponsors and everybody that's connected with the Olympics getting a comp ticket and getting the events of their choice. And they may not be able to attend all of those events. I think that one of the ways to handle that is to, A, make sure a lot of people pay for their tickets.
More likely to use it.
Yeah, exactly. They're more likely to use it. Also, show up. And if you're not there within, you know, 15 minutes of the start or you know, 15 minutes to the start of the event, your ticket then goes on sale.
Well, it doesn't even have to go on sale. What I think they should do at events like this is have the local school kids on call. You have them, you bring them in, you give them a free lunch, you give them a t-shirt. They fill up the seats. You know, 10 minutes after the thing begins, they go in, they sit down. If a person with a ticket shows up, the attendant moves the kids. Kids are thrilled. They get to be there for 20 minutes or half an hour or most of the event. They're great. They're happy. They're fine. They're having a blast. They see half an hour of gymnastics, 20 minutes of swimming. You know, they're going to have a great time. They'll be happy as clams. They get off from school. It creates goodwill for the local community, and it puts bums in the seats and makes it look good for the cameras.
First of all, it's the summer, so they should be off from school for the most part.
Well, there are kids available. You contact the schools. It doesn't mean they have to be in class.
No. I mean, they don't have to take off.
Well, there's also summer school. There's also all sorts of things, and school years are different around the world. They don't all have 3 months off in the summer like America still does, which is kind of archaic. But whatever it is, you contact the local schools. You work with the school groups, community groups. You get kids and people who are in the local community who could never afford a ticket. Let them be volunteers to fill seats. They get a free t-shirt. They get to see some Olympic events. They're happy. You hear, oh, go over to this stadium. We need 100 people here. You know, what's the big deal? It seems easy enough to me.
You know, Telluride, the film festival every year in Colorado over Labor Day, does the same thing. They sell all of these tickets to all of their screenings. And then inevitably, 5, 10, 15, 20 people don't make it. And so people in a standby line, the first 20 people will go in, you know, buy a ticket and go into the screening, and all the seats are filled when the lights go down and the movie starts. So there are ways to combat that.
Yeah, exactly. And it just looks terrible on TV and makes people angry because they would love to be there and yet they can't.
Right.
Well, that's it for the Olympics. I think we've discussed enough of it. It's fun. It's a blast. I'm watching it nonstop because I'm crazy about it. The British win in men's gymnastics was very exciting. They medaled for the first time in like 100 years. It was great television, and I could tell something was going on because it was in prime time, but it was not early on in the evening. Gymnastics, women's, of course, is a bigger draw, but men's gymnastics is a big draw, and it was delayed to later in the night, and I was like going, I bet the U.S. men didn't do very well.
Right,
and
exactly.
They didn't. They stumbled terribly. It was painful. I love those guys. I've interviewed some of them. I've watched them in person, and it's so painful. You train all your life, not just for 4 years, but all your life for this one moment, this one day, this 1 minute. And you stumble it's just heartbreaking. But that's why we love the Olympics.
Well, what about the world champion woman gymnast who came in fourth overall, but she can't compete because you can only have two members from each country compete in the all-around.
It's not the rule so much as her performance that day that what messed her up. And that's what happens at the Olympics. You've got to be on top of your game that day. You don't get credit for what you've done in the past. You're the best swimmer in the world. You show up and you have to swim. You know, like preliminary heats, another heat, a semifinal, just to get to the final where then you want to go all out after having swum three times. It's incredibly difficult. But I've never really liked the women's gymnastics as much because they're too young. I just do not enjoy watching these 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old girls with that. They just feel a little young. The men are in college. They're a little bit old. They're 18, 19, 20. The women are often 16, 17. They're just a little bit younger. They always get burst into tears. I just find it too raw and too painful to watch the pressure on those kids. And Bella Caroli, of course, is saying, why do you not let girls 14 compete? If they can compete, they should compete.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I do agree with Caroli. And I guess this is the first year where you have this two, and this is, we're not a sports podcast, so maybe we should move on. But this is the first year, if I'm not mistaken, where you have this rule that you, in the individual all-around competition, you can only have two members from each country compete. And instead of picking the top 25 finishers, they pick two from the U.S., two from the U.K., two from France, you know, all of those top.
Yes, only the best should compete, not the best. We've already got enough partitioning by country so that they're there at the Olympics. They've got their shot. Once they're there, it should be based on performance, not on country.
Right.
I agree with you. But I was referring more to the role in women's gymnastics, which I believe is unique, that you must be at least 16 during the year of the Olympics in order to compete. Which means if you're 14 or 15, you can be the best in the world, but you cannot compete. And I believe, I'm not sure, it's the only sport that has that qualification because they're so young when they're competing in women's gymnastics. They can be so flexible and do things that you were seeing a lot of 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. And they decided, again, that the pressure was just too great and was not right to have people that young. But, of course, that means you could be 15, you know, this year, and means until you're 19, you don't get to compete in the Olympics. It's really hard.
Bread.
But it's fascinating. You say it's not a sports podcast. You know what? Everybody's a sports expert during the Olympics. I watch the dive and I say, ah, they're out of rotation. Ah, that, look at that splash. You know, we all become instant experts in all the events. That's why we love the Olympics. And people also love Modern Family.
Ooh, that yes, is what do. I call a transition. Yes.
Modern Family is the ABC sitcom, and the lawsuit, the long national nightmare, is over. Tell us about it, Sperling.
Well, yes. I don't know if it was long. It was about a week long, a couple days long, really. Last week when we recorded, it was breaking news at the time that Modern Family, the cast basically said, look, we don't agree on a new contract. We want raises. You're not giving them to us. And so we're not going to sit down and do the table read for the first episode of the new season. And
do you think the world, the new era that we live in, affects these proceedings? Because in the old days, people wouldn't have even known about this. But now we heard about it. We heard they didn't show up for a table reading. Then we heard they did show up for a table reading. We got tweets from the cast members saying, oh, we know it's, you know, we just want our fair share. We have, you know, fans speaking out, the pressure, the media, you know, there's so much more awareness of these contract negotiations. And people can look greedy saying, well, they make, you know, $200,000 an episode and they're complaining. On the other hand, people are a lot more savvy now. So they go, wow, this show's going to make $1 billion for ABC. Why aren't they want to fork over some money to the stars, the people who really matter? You know, I just feel like this happened in a week, but it was big news for the entire week. And every back and forth was in the news and people won that media war, good and bad. And you had the TCA event, which is the event where critics come together and let the networks make their presentation about the fall. And I think all of that contributed to the fact that this was intense. It was big news. Even people not in the industry knew about it. And it was over in a week. And they got what they wanted.
Yes, that is. I mean, I think you've just summed it up quite nicely, actually. I don't really need to add anything. I think that to answer your question directly, I think, you know, certainly it was news when, like, the cast of Everybody Loves Raymond in the 90s kind of went on strike, or at least one or two of them did. And
the cast of Friends negotiated as a group, which seems to be the real trend, and I think it's a smart one for the actors.
Yeah, I think in this case, that the reason it was big news, well, a couple reasons. One, they were negotiating as a group, and two, as you say, there's all this social media, there's a lot more awareness of it. The actors and actresses can actually speak directly to fans, so can networks. The network.
Not that that's ever a good idea.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's also the biggest comedy on television as far as a combination of critical reviews, Emmys, and ratings. It's a game changer for ABC. It's helping them launch other shows. Its value goes beyond even the substantial value it brings them directly.
Right. And, you know, I guess Ed O'Neill, who is one of the kind of elder statesmen on the show, and he has a separate and a much better deal than what all of the other actors and actresses had, the rest of the cast, he joined the lawsuit as well. And so he was out. And then once the cast had their new salary agreed to, and they, as you say, they got everything they wanted, they got their new salaries, now the kids want a raise.
That's right. The kids banded together and say, it's our turn. We want some money too. And they should. The kids get no Emmy love. They're good actors, especially the son of Sofia Vergara and Ed O'Neill. That actor is pretty talented. His Manny is the character's name. I forget the actor's name. You know, he gets a lot of attention and buzz, gets no Emmy love. These kids are not going to make anywhere near what the adults make, but they have a pretty big burden. You know, they have a lot of screen time. So they banded together and said, we want a raise too. I'm sure they'll get it. And again, this is all the negotiating they have is to say, hey, you want an eighth season of this show? Because they're all signed for 7 seasons. It used to be 5. I don't know when it went to 7. But apparently now if you want to be in a show, you have to commit to 7 years. So they all committed to 7 years, but now ABC knows they want an eighth. And this is their opportunity to say, all right, you want an eighth season, you got to give us more money. And that's when they're cashing in, which is what, of course, they should do. But frankly, no show should run for 8 seasons. But that's a creative issue, not a commercial one.
Well, now, last year at this time, we were talking a lot about a music service that was in negotiations with big labels instead of a cast with big networks. It was Spotify trying to come into the U.S. and gain the rights to stream music here in North America. And they finally launched last July. And so they've been around for an entire year. And this week, they announced some figures for the U.S.
How are they doing, Sperling?
Well, as of July 14th, 2011 to today, they have, I guess what, 1 million U.S. users?
No, they have more than 3 million.
More than 3 million U.S. users, 20% of which are actually paying.
So they have 600,000 people who actually pay money for their service.
Yes.
Is that low to you or is that high?
That's about right. When you give away something for free.
Wouldn't 6 million be even righter? How is that right?
Well, I think that when you give away something for free, you do so knowing that you have like what's called a 95-5 rule. 95% of the people will not pay, but the 5% that do will pay for themselves as well as all of those that don't pay. plus
some. So in this case, having an 80-20 breakdown means that they're ahead of the game?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that they would love to make it 30-70 or 40-60, but for right now, 1 year in, and with all these music services being new, I think they're doing okay.
Okay.
They've streamed more than 13 billion songs here in the U.S., and they've shared over 27 million songs, almost 28 million songs. And, you know, I would say most of those, 55%, came from Facebook, because you just have to share everything on Facebook, apparently. Mm-hmm. And all those apps that are on Spotify, 23.7 million hours of usage was what they announced last week. That's how much those apps are used.
And of course, how much money goes back to the artist? We could break it down by the 10th, 100th, 1,000th of a penny, but the easiest way to describe it is
which
that,
you'd have to do, by the way. You'd have to break it down to a 1,000th of a penny.
They pay very little money per song use, but you would say if a song is played 47 times on premium Spotify, that would equal about what an artist would get if they sold a single on iTunes.
Okay.
So, you know, it's on demand. I don't know what artists are actually getting, but that's, you know, it seems a little high, I guess, 47 times just to get the equivalent of buying a single once, but it's something.
Yeah. And then now if you're the artist, go and try and prove it. Good luck with the audit.
Well, you know, now you're claiming that Spotify is going to fudge their numbers and not want to be accurate because they have a third party body that audits that?
Yeah. SoundScan.
Okay. Well, what do you mean? You're saying the artist can't trust SoundScan?
Well, Spotify pays SoundScan. SoundScan pays the labels and the artists, depending on who is who at the end of the day and who they're registered with. But a lot of artists are complaining that they're not getting paid by the labels for their Spotify and other streaming services
as well.
That's
a different issue than whether Spotify is accurately paying the amount of money that they owe.
Yes. No, this is not has nothing to do with Spotify accurately paying. Spotify is paying. It's whether the labels are then passing that money along.
Well, one thing is clear. If you are an artist and you create a TV show or a book or an album or any sort of work of art and you need to get paid money over the years for how it's used and spent, and you have to constantly have your lawyers watching them. You have to constantly demand audits. You have to constantly demand and sue in order to get the money you deserve, because that's just the history of the business. And we'll have some more lawsuits which come up every week, frankly, but we'll have some more lawsuits in Big Deal, Big Whoop. Tell us about Modest Yahoo.
Yeah, well, you know, even before Modest Yahoo, well, I guess, I mean, I don't know which one you want to talk about first. You're talking about, you know, getting payments.
Oh,
well,
there you go. Go right there.
Yeah, Major League, you know, Michael and I are looking at the show notes and we can see this story about how major labels are now admitting that, yeah, we went after Pirate Bay and yes, we won and the people behind Pirate Bay have to go to jail. And we won this lawsuit where we got 550,000 euros or about $677,000, but if we're able to collect anything, because according to financial records, the people behind Pirate Bay don't own anything and have no assets, if we're able to get anything, the major labels, which include EMI, Universal Music, Sony Music, etc., they are going to then give that money not to the artists, but to IFPI, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry. So it's like the RIAA, but in Europe. And they're going to give them that money in order to fund campaigns against, guess what? Piracy.
Well, I guess the argument is that they can't figure out exactly who would deserve what. You know, I mean, it's money from Pirate Bay. These people, they don't have access to Pirate Bay records. They can't determine what artists were downloaded or stolen or streamed more often than others. Who would you give the money to? It's it's a little over $500,000. So in the context of a, you know, $7 billion industry, as far as recorded music, it's a good amount of money, but it's not a lot. So I think they just said the easiest thing to do is just, hey, let's just funnel it back into fighting more piracy, which ultimately will benefit our artists. That's their argument. I don't think it's necessarily a wrong one. I don't know how the IFPI is using it or might use it or whether it's any good, and they won't get any money anyway. So it's sort of a mute argument.
I think actually one of the better ways to earn money these days is doing exactly what Modest Yahoo is doing here on Spotify. You know, they have all of these apps, as I mentioned, that had 23 million hours of usage. Well, they now have artist apps. So the artists can come in and create an app either around their music or around music they listen to. And it's special, you know, whether it's special songs or special tracks. It's really interesting. Modest Yahoo is kind of a reggae and hip hop and alternative rock musician. He is one of the first artists to actually use one of these apps on Spotify and to release his music that way. And he said, quote, "I wanted to take the completed record one step further and allow the fans to listen to how the arrangements were constructed, what instruments were used, and really take my fans along the journey that went into making this new record." and he partnered with Spotify.
Right, it's sort of a it's sort of like bonus features or behind the scenes stuff. He's sort of letting you see instead of outtakes of a movie. This is sort of the skeletal and the demo arrangements of songs that made it to his final album. So it's for fans who love his music. It's sort of a way to peek into the creative process and see the steps that he took to get to that final album. So if you're a Modest Yahoo fan, of course, you're going to be interested, and it'll make you more likely to buy the finished album.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't pirate that those kinds of extras. And, you know, the industry, the way they've been fighting piracy has always, in my opinion, not necessarily worked. And in fact, the RIAA knew that when they were sponsoring SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, that it wouldn't help with piracy at all. But they just kind of backed it anyway.
Well, I don't know about that. This was sort of the online story of the last week. A lot of geek websites were talking about it. There was a leak of a presentation report from an RIAA official. And in that presentation, as it was reported, they said, oh, they knew it wouldn't work and it wasn't going to stop piracy, but they did it anyway. Here are some of the facts. Music sales have dropped from $12 billion in 2005 to $7 billion in 2011. That's recorded music. 65% of music consumption, they reckon, is stolen. That means people pay for about 35% of the music they use and steal 65% of it. So I buy CDs, and for every CD I buy, there's two people who are probably stealing two CDs. That's sort of what it is. Two-thirds is stolen. One-third is actually legally paid for. Most of the stolen music comes not from the internet. This is according to the RIA, but from the sneaker net. That's their word for people who physically hand off like thumb drives with, you know, albums. Say, hey, you got to listen to this album. Here's a thumb drive with, you know, my 100 CDs, or here's this new album I love. You should check it out. And they download it that way, or they just rip the CDs that their friend has bought. That's where the majority of stealing comes from, according to the RIAA. That's about half of all music consumption. It's kind of amazing. Only 4%, they say, comes from digital lockers like Mega Upload, and I guess Pirate Bay is sort of like it. And 15% comes from peer-to-peer stealing online. I guess that's what Pirate Bay is,
yes,
more
correct.
Like.
Yes, correct. Yeah, it's a torrent site. So,
all right. So they said, oh, see, that's only 15% comes from peer-to-peer. I'm like, well, all right, but that's 20% from digital lockers and peer-to-peer, 20% of a big business is quite a lot. You know, if you figure 35% of music is legal and 65% is stolen, that means this industry had about $20 billion in potential sales last year, except $13 billion of it was stolen. And, you know, $4 billion of it came from peer-to-peer and digital lockers. Well, $4 billion is a lot of money.
Well, and every time you ask the RIAA or the MPAA for those numbers, they never give them. And
What numbers?
Well, sorry, the evidence behind those numbers, the actual documentation to say, here's how we came up with this.
Well, it ain't easy. A, it isn't easy, but B, these are their numbers, and they're not claiming 80% of sales. People were mocking him and saying, oh, see how low these numbers are. It's only 15%. I'm like, well, 15% is a lot.
Well, 1% is a lot. 1%. Right. I mean, when if somebody's stealing something, it's being stolen.
Right. Well, 1% would be perhaps a fair amount of loss that you would accept in a business. You're a grocery store, you're a clothing store, you're going to lose 1% to theft in office. Yeah. But 20% is a lot. However, the biggest thing I say is that everybody focused on this comment. It was a vague one-line comment in the report that said that SOPA was, quote, not likely to have been an effective tool for music, end quote. Well, all right. That doesn't mean it wasn't a fight worth making. I don't like SOPA, but that isn't some sort of damning, oh my God, they knew SOPA was a joke. It just means, hey, they wanted it, but it's the best they could come up with, and they didn't know how effective it would be, or probably wouldn't be that effective. Nonetheless, doesn't mean that they were hypocrites for pushing for it. Well, it just means that they were dumb and weren't focused on the right way to combat piracy.
And I'd like to see what these studies are about piracy now that all these streaming services where you can get pretty much any song you want, you can play it at any time. I'd love to know.
Figure it's got to be down, right?
Yeah, I think it might be down. And I think the same thing would be true in the film industry where, you know, sites like Netflix and, you know, in the UK, Love Film and other services, I guess BSkyB has a service now. You know, all those services, you can watch almost any movie at any time for $9 a month or in...
You got to pay for it, though.
You have to pay for it, but it's within
Unlike
reason.
Unlike Spotify.
Well, correct, yeah. Spotify, there's no, you know...
Right, so there's no reason to steal it if you can listen to it for free on Spotify.
Correct, yes.
That's your point. Netflix, you got to pay no matter what unless you're ripping it off.
Right, and, you know, they actually announced some earnings this past week.
Who's they?
Netflix, in this case.
Oh, okay.
And they promised, I guess, 2 cents per share for, you know, that's what their earnings were going to be. And analysts expected about 5 cents per share. And the final results were 11 cents per share. So above
success.
Revenue climbed 13% to $889 million. And earnings, of course, in the black, hitting $6.2 million. And a sharp increase from, I guess, what, $4.4 million a year ago, I think it was?
That's what they lost. So it's a $10 million swing. They went from losing $4.4 million last year to last quarter a year ago to earning $6 million this quarter. So that's a huge, you know, swing.
Well, that totally explains why their stock stumbled 25% to a 52-week low right afterwards.
What?
Yeah, I mean, I've never understood that. You know, analysts wanted Netflix to add 800,000 subscribers, and they could only, I guess, rustle up 533,000 domestic streamers. So here in the United States.
So they said they didn't meet their expectations about signing up new subscribers. That was the problem.
Right. So they're not actually all the, you know, the reason the stock dropped is not bets on what's going on right now, but bets on what's going on down the line when revenue down the line might not meet expectations. And they have about 22.7, 23 million subscribers, so you know
that's in North America.
Yeah, and another 3 million international.
Yeah.
So yeah, why don't we talk about that? Because they actually announced that Ireland and the UK, they've been there 6 months, and they were very excited to say that they now have half of the number of subscribers as Love Film, which has been there for 10 years. And
Love Film is the Amazon service that's the equivalent to Netflix that they've launched overseas.
Right. Well, no, Amazon purchased Love Film. Love Film was there for 10 years. Amazon came in, I think, last year and purchased them, and they have 2 million subscribers. Netflix, after 6 months, has 1 million subscribers.
I wonder why they're doing so well, or why Love Film wasn't able to build quicker.
Well, you know, first of all, Netflix has been in the news quite a bit. They've had a 10-year run here in the United States. The publicity is already there. Love Film has kind of broken the seal on that. They also invested very heavily in all of this advertising and marketing. So, you know, it took them 10 years to get to 23 million subscribers here, or 13 years, really, to get to 23 million subscribers here in the United States. And, you know, at this point, it's kind of more of a more mature market. So it doesn't take as long to get to a million.
And of course, they're also competing with BSkyB, which is the satellite company. They're offering, even if you don't have a satellite subscription, you can get their movie, you know, streaming or movie on-demand service, which is about £15 per month.
Which is expensive. So, that's very expensive. It's twice as much as Netflix and Love Film.
But they have all the big recent blockbusters because they have exclusive deals early on from all the big studios. So if you want to see the new releases when they come out on become available, you got to go to BSkyB first, or you got to wait 6 months or 9 months or a year before they come out to Netflix.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, Netflix's catalog is old, at least in the UK and Ireland. Now, because they're doing so well in the UK and Ireland and in Great Britain, it looks like Netflix is saying, hey, you know what? Now would be a great time to go conquer Western Europe. So they're going to start launching in, I guess, France and Germany and Spain. And
isn't Ireland like Western Europe too?
Yes, but I you know.
And you can't say the UK and Ireland. Ireland is in the UK.
Well, Ireland is actually the Republic of Ireland, as opposed to Northern Ireland, which is in the UK.
Ah.
And yes, a lot of people make that mistake. And or a lot of people believe that Ireland is a part of the UK, and it's a bone of contention.
It's England, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland is part of the United Kingdom. I'm sorry. It's true.
Northern Ireland, not the Republic of Ireland.
I don't know what their political structure is now. Isn't it a little more vague now?
No. The Republic of Ireland is the Republic of Ireland. It's a completely separate country.
But Ireland is, you could still refer to North. I don't think people in Northern Ireland refer to themselves as Northern Ireland. They call themselves Ireland. They don't say we're Northern Ireland, like West Germany. They say we're Ireland. When you live there, they say we live in Ireland. They don't say we live in Northern Ireland.
They actually do say, you know, it's up in the north or it's in Northern
Ireland. They say we live in Ireland.
Yeah, they do make a distinction.
Politically, it's divided. I understand that, but Ireland is Ireland. I understand that politically, there's the Republic of Ireland, there's Northern Ireland, which is a part of the UK. But it's all Ireland. They don't say, I live in Northern Ireland, like South Carolina versus North Carolina. They all live in Ireland. Politically, there's a divide. But as a land and a region, it is all Ireland.
When I was there last year, they actually did say, you know, people would make the difference, especially if you were from Belfast. They would say, I'm from Belfast, meaning, hey.
Well, that's like saying I live in Manhattan, isn't it? I mean, it's still New York City. Manhattan, Queens, Bronx, Staten Island, you know, it's still Brooklyn. It's still
well. It's
New
kind
York
of like
City.
Saying, yeah. I guess the equivalent would be when you say you're from New York, you don't want people to think you're from Albany or from Buffalo. You say I'm from New York City, or I'm from Manhattan, or I'm from Queens, that you really kind of say, hey, I'm from here. Here's where I'm from. And that's effectively what they would say. They'd say, oh, I'm from insert name of city in Northern Ireland.
I remember Mitt Romney just getting in trouble for saying he was going to visit England. No, he wasn't. He was going to visit the United Kingdom.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. You know, it's because he didn't visit just, you know, England. He visited, you know, other parts of the UK as well. Anyway, enough of the geography lesson. But it is all Ireland. Whatever the political divide, it's Ireland.
Either way, they have a million subscribers between the Ireland and the UK, and they are now going to launch in other Western European countries.
And of course, yes, they want. That's where they think they're going to make money, right?
I guess so. Yeah,
they're saying maybe our signing up of viewers is slowing down in the U.S., but it's going to expand greatly overseas, and we've got the brand and the people to do it.
And they think that's a big deal.
All right, let's move on to big deal or big whoop.
Yeah, that was my lame way of. I don't know what it is lately. I cannot transition into big deal or big whoop the way
don't
I
try.
I used to. Maybe that's it. I'm trying too hard, some of those athletes in the Olympics.
Oh yeah.
But well, big deal or big whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. So which is it, CNN? The company's constant explanation for its ratings freefall. And the ratings freefall, guess what? Primetime is at its lowest ratings in 21 years, and the entire day ratings are at an 11-year low. You know, their excuse is that TV ratings are so 2010. CNN has been telling one and all that if it reaches a terrific, that it does reach a terrific younger audience on CNN.com, and that its streaming videos and tweets and web presence is exponentially better than its competitors. They've got viewers. CNN insists they have viewers. It's just that they are young and now online. So then why is Jim Walton, the head of CNN Worldwide, stepping down after 10 years and admitting, and this is a quote, CNN needs new thinking. That starts with a new leader who brings a different perspective, different experiences, and a new plan. One who will build on our great foundation and will commit to seeing it through. So is Walton's departure, or maybe it's a firing, who knows, a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, nobody gets fired much. It's pretty hard to get fired. It's a big deal. CNN is in freefall in primetime ratings. No matter how well you're doing online in other areas, no matter how well you measure your audience and say, no, we've got a lot of people on our website. You want to have that primetime as the engine driving all those other areas, and you cannot ignore 21-year lows. That's just not good. Though, you know, Jeff Bukes, the head of Time Warner, points out that their earnings were in big decline when Walton took over, and under his tenure, earnings have tripled and margins have doubled, and they earned a record $500 million just 2 years ago in 2009. So, 3 years ago, I guess. So, you know, there is some good news from his tenure, but, you know, that free fall in prime time just cannot be papered over any longer.
Hey, Michael, do you own any video games?
Yes, I do.
Are you certain you own them?
What do you mean?
Well, what if they're a digital download? Because chances are you don't own that video game, but are just licensing it if it's a digital download. However, GameStop, the retailer that sells both new and used video games, wants to help you resell your digital downloads. They're looking at technology and talking to companies about creating the ability to resell your digital download along with the key to use it that keeps the seller from still using the game. And it gives the buyer, of course, full access and you know, trickiest of all, They have to do this without angering all those video game manufacturers, those pesky manufacturers. GameStop says reselling digital downloads is hardly in high demand yet, but they can see the way the industry is going and want to start laying the groundwork now, which is very smart of them, I think. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
No, I think it's a very big deal, actually. This is going to be happening not just in video games, but music and books, because every company out there is going to insist, no, you don't have the right to sell your ebook. You don't have the right to sell your e-album. You don't have the right to sell your video game. You just borrowed the right to use it, and we can take that back whenever we want, to which people would say, what? And there has to be some lawsuits going on. And there was no quote in this story from the industry saying, yes, we're going to work with GameStop and other people to help make this a reality and regulate the marketplace, which is what they should do. But there was no quote from them saying, hey, we will sue you as soon as you try to sell a digital download. But that's what's going to happen. This is going to go to court. It's going to be a big case, and we're going to need a test case so that people can establish the right to resell the ebooks that they buy, resell the video games that they buy, and resell the music that they buy in digital form. And the industry needs to start working now to create a platform and a way to do that so that people lose the music that they buy somehow, lose the book, lose the video game, and it can be passed on to someone else properly and legally and clearly, because this is a right that people have, and it's gonna come up in its day in court. And I think that the people who own these digital versions are gonna win.
Well, we're going to talk about that in just a second. There was a court case last year, or maybe it was, yeah, it was 2010. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals made a ruling in Werner versus Autodesk that the original vendor could limit the applicant, and in this case, the manufacturer, could limit the application of the first sale doctrine. And we'll talk about that in a second. But first, let's talk about how Warner Brothers is filing this mass lawsuit against some Amazon customer resellers, which kind of plays into this
last story.
I know
someone who does this.
Yeah, the studio filed at least 16 different lawsuits against resellers on Amazon.com. Customers who use the Amazon marketplace to sell purportedly new or used copies of movies, TV shows, books, albums, and, you know, all the stuff like that. And they sell them to other Amazon customers. And Amazon takes a little cut of the proceeds, kind of like eBay. Now, this is not about people selling used DVDs, apparently. Warner Brothers is alleging that Amazon is now a marketplace for counterfeit copies of movies, like, say, the Harry Potter franchise. And these aren't just, like, cheapo, one-off, camera copies. These are professional-looking bootleg copies of movies that, you know, populate the street corners, probably in New York. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I can't believe that Amazon has not a bigger way of regulating people who are selling stuff online. I mean, there's so many users and so many people that sort of say, hey, look, we can't keep an oversight on all of that. If anybody complains, we'll look into it and act accordingly. But I'm astonished to know that people were selling bootleg copies. That's kind of stunning.
Now, you say you know somebody who is selling bootleg copies?
No. I know someone who's legally selling real stuff,
okay.
Who has a business where they buy stuff from people and then they resell it on Amazon because, that's the world that we live in now. It's so cheap to get stuff. You just have to compete with all those people online. You can't open up a store to sell used DVDs anymore or used CDs. It's really hard to make a living out of that because they can go on Amazon and get cheaper copies. So I know someone who actually deals in used copies of official merchandise, and I had no idea they were competing with people who were just selling bootleg copies. So that's kind of amazing. I had no idea that that might be going on. It makes sense, I guess, because it's hard to regulate and hard to pay attention.
Now, used DVD, you would have the right to sell because presumably, you purchase the DVD, and when you purchase it and you own that DVD, you don't own the rights to the movie, but you own the right to resell that DVD to somebody else. And that's called first sale doctrine.
Right, now, like if you buy a book, a physical book or a CD, but they claim that if you buy a digital version of that, well, you don't have that right anymore.
Right, because you're not actually buying a copy of the DVD
or the
movie. And
you think you are, and I believe you are legally, and that will be decided in court, and someday it will go to the Supreme Court, and we'll get a ruling on that. And I think the argument that you're only licensing it is malarkey.
Right, and basically that's exactly, you just hit the nail on the head. It's a way for video game manufacturers, movie studios, record companies
to sell
to
it again and again and again.
Right, you don't own it. You have the right to use that music. You have the right to watch that movie, but you don't have the right to own it. Therefore, you cannot resell it as used copy.
And they have the right to take it back whenever they want, to which people would say, oh, really?
Right, exactly.
By the way, it's July 31st, a Tuesday when we're recording this show, mentioning Harry Potter. Happy birthday, Harry Potter, because it is his birthday. He was born on July 31st.
And he's 10 years old now. Wait, what?
No, 1980. He's 32.
Okay, wow. Wow,
he's getting up. Yeah, he's got kids now. They're at Hogwarts, and everything's going well.
Well, speaking of going well, in a completely unshocking development, Comedy Central has extended the contracts of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. Stewart's The Daily Show is the number one show in late night in the 18 to 49 demo, the one that advertisers covet the most, averaging 1.4 million viewers nightly, more than Jay Leno, David Letterman, and everybody else. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, of course they're going to get renewed. His show is going up for an Emmy. It's about to go for its 10th straight Emmy in a row in a category that they're competing in, The Daily Show, that is. He doesn't have a ton of viewers, but every single one of them is age 18 to 49. I don't know what happens when I turn 50. Do I have to stop watching the show? I mean,
by law, yes, you do.
By law, I guess I do.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, it's not even the top-rated show on Comedy Central. That is Tosh.0.
Which you shouldn't be watching at all. You're too old for that show.
That's too dumb. I'm way too intelligent to watch that show. Because I've glanced at it, and it's stupid.
Speaking of stupid, looks like Peter Jackson will make a third Hobbit movie. Now, keep in mind, one book. So, for fans of Lord of the Rings, it is big news last week that Peter Jackson is turning The Hobbit into a trilogy. And this would apparently...
Big news for the Warner Brothers. I mean, it's an extra $1 billion. Thank you very much.
Exactly. This would apparently involve several months of shooting in 2013. And of course, they'd have to provide salary extensions for all the actors involved, who, by the way, have their own commitments. They're not committed to make a third film. And they have to secure the rights in a very complicated property. They have to rework the scripts and the movies that have already been shot. You know, this was the original plan when Jackson conceived the Hobbit with Benicio del Toro. And when Del Toro was going to direct, it was going to be three movies. They'd make two movies based on The Hobbit and a third film to bridge between The Hobbit story and the first part of Lord of the Rings, because apparently people can't do that in their mind. I don't get it. But no one is really sure how this expansion would work yet, because Jackson is, of course, being mum on the details. But we do know the third film will come out in the summer of 2014, just six or so months after part two. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. I keep saying big deal today, but it is. It's a big deal for Warner Brothers. They can make a lot of money. It's very scary. When they originally announced this three-part version where they make two Hobbit in two parts and then a bridge based on the stories that are referenced in The Hobbit or referred to in the notes or the little addendums in the book of The Lord of the Rings, you know, passing references, they were going to cobble all the stuff together and create a third film to bridge between The Hobbit Part 2 and The Fellowship of the Ring. I thought, wow, that's really iffy. The Hobbit as two movies, yes, I can totally buy that. And for people who say, how can you turn one book into three movies? Well, you know what? I mean, if you read The Hobbit, the unabridged version, if you buy it in the stores, unabridged, The Hobbit takes like 11 or 12 hours to read out loud. So, you know, 12 hours to tell the story of The Hobbit is not really that much when you think about just, you could do a 10-hour miniseries of The Hobbit easily.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot, you know, you could have made 30 hours of The Lord of the Rings if you wanted to tell every beat of that story, and it probably would have been great. So this is not really stretching it out so exorbitantly, but movies condense and tell things in a quicker, better pace. Two movies out of The Hobbit seem like the right length. I'm pretty nervous about it, but we'll have to see how they do. I'm certainly rooting for them. But there was one fan who said exactly what you said, Sperling. I looked at the comments on Facebook under Peter Jackson's page, and one fan said, how is it the other three books fit into one movie each, but the first book is three movies?
Right,
to which
exactly.
Another fan responded, only one thing to say to those not happy about this announcement. Cline val ar or car tur ai martar, which I assume is Elvish for shut the hell up. But
or could be, you know, isn't that Klingon?
No, I know. I said it like Klingon, but I didn't make it sound Elvishy. I spoke it in Klingon. I didn't mean to.
Well,
that's the only fantasy language that I speak fluently.
Okay. I didn't know you spoke a second language, and that second language was Elvish. Well, you know, we were talking about lawsuits just a moment ago, but here is an interesting case. The FCC ruled last week that the cable provider Comcast, and you know how I feel about this, Michael. You know where I'm going with this. They unfairly discriminated against the Tennis Channel. In a 3-2 ruling that split along party lines, the FCC ruled that Comcast must place the Tennis Channel in the same tier as the sports channels it owns outright, say the Golf Channel, or don't they own NBC? So NBC Sports. Plus, it must pay a $375,000 fine, or as Comcast likes to say, the bill for lunch. This puts the Tennis Channel into potentially 18 million more homes just as the U.S. Open begins in late August. The Tennis Channel says it's an important check on the monopolistic powers of cable providers and their ability to harm or promote independent channels. Comcast says it's intrusive interference into their business practices and First Amendment rights, and they are appealing this decision. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
What can I say? It's a big deal. It's fascinating. I don't know what the right ruling is for this, frankly.
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. I think that
if
you own, I mean, this is, you know, part, and I realize that, you know, Comcast and NBC, they're not part of the Paramount decree, but it effectively said you cannot be vertically integrated and manufacture the content, distribute the content, and exhibit the content. So that's when the studios had to sell all their movie theaters. Well, this is the same concept. And what the Tennis Channel is saying is, hey, you know what? We'd love to be in Comcast's bundle there, but they keep pushing us to the side to make room for and give preferential treatment to the channels that they control and that they own and that they have launched. And wasn't that supposed to be part of the deal that Comcast buys NBC Universal, but they can't do that? The Tennis Channel is within their rights to go to the FCC and say, you're giving them the rights to be a multi-video program distributor. You have to kind of enforce your own rules.
Well, the question is, what tier is fair or not fair? If they kept them off the Comcast entirely, I would agree with you. Making them a premium channel, like they're a premium channel on HBO. I have to pay a couple dollars a month to get the Big Ten Network, the Tennis Channel, and two or three other channels that I normally wouldn't get as far as the basic package or even the expanded package that I have. I don't like paying that extra amount. I wish they were on a lower tier and I got them for free. I love the Tennis Channel and the Big Ten Network, but I'm not sure what tier on their channel is a level where I can say, well, it's okay if they put them in the 400s, but it's not okay if they put them in the 800s. You know, what number channel should they be? How much should they be able to charge for them?
Well, I think, you know,
is it unfair if they're not part of the basic cable package? I don't know.
No, I don't think it's unfair. I think that basically,
well, why not? What if Comcast's own channels, the Golf Channel, NBC Sports, were part of the basic cable chat package? Would it then be unfair?
Yes. If they put
anything that Comcast does with its own wholly owned channels, it has to do for every other sports channel out there, because there are dozens and dozens of sports channels. What about ESPN4? What about ESPN College? What about ESPN? Lacrosse?
Well, that's why I say that there should be a sports package and specialty channels, channels that focus on a specific sport like Major League Baseball or the NBA.
Well, there are specialty tiers.
Yeah.
And that's what the Tennis Network was on, presumably on this on their network. Under Time Warner, it's on a specialty tier with a bundle of other sports channels, not with ESPN. That's part of my basic package, not with some other channels that are maybe available on a cheaper or different package. But the package that I bought includes the Tennis Channel.
Okay, well then,
I mean, I like the ruling in a way. I in a sense, in philosophically, I go, oh, good. I want them to be as widely available as possible. I like the Tennis Channel. I'm very wary of the idea that Comcast would be abusing their power and keeping them off a tier where they otherwise would have put them, because they say, oh, they're competition and they're unfairly using their power that they have as the bridge keeper to keep them away from a lot of people. But they were available on Comcast. They were available on a tier. They weren't saying you have to charge $20.
Yes, but if their specialty channel focusing on a single sport is the Golf Channel and it's on basic cable, then another specialty channel, which they don't own, like
but
the Tennis
golf
Channel.
Golf is a much bigger audience than tennis. I love tennis, but golf
but
is a much bigger
that?
Draw.
I mean
that's true. Golf is a much bigger draw on major networks than tennis. Tennis gets very little draw. I'm sorry, I wish it did. Bull riding comes on the NBC Sports Channel. I love bull riding. It ain't a big draw right
you
now.
You love bull riding?
I love bull riding.
Oh,
I love a lot of sports. But, you know, if you're talking about Major League Baseball and football, those are much bigger draws than tennis and lacrosse and soccer.
Right, so, and they're on the basic tier.
Yeah, Major League Baseball is not on the basic cable network package. It is not.
It's online.
So, not in Time Warner. So, again, they're saying, look, you're getting into the nitty-gritty of our business and what tier we put people on. And it's like, we didn't say they couldn't be on. We didn't, you know, it's getting pretty granular when you're getting that involved in what tier they put them on and how much they charge. Unless it's a gross thing, like they say, okay, we'll put you Tennis Channel on, but we're only going to let people get it if they pay $10 a subscriber, which would make it completely unpopular. No one would want it.
Well, this is like in technology manufacturing, this is like a FRAND license. That's what the FCC said that Comcast would have to offer to, and the equivalent, they didn't say you have to offer a FRAND license. FRAND stands for fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. They basically said, look, we'll let you buy NBC Universal, but you can't discriminate against channels you don't own.
I'm just not convinced that tier was not FRAND.
Okay.
FRAND friendly. I'm not. I'm glad, though, because philosophically, but I'm not sure that was necessarily a clear abuse of power. Let's move on.
Okay, then. Let's move on to the New York Review of Books, who seems to be embracing digital. One of the best ongoing series in publishing, in fact, is the reissues program from the New York Review of Books. Their distinctive spines always catch your eye because the NYRB, as it's known to the insiders, shows great and discerning taste in uncovering terrific novels that have fallen out of favor or simply just disappeared off the literary radar. You can almost never go wrong taking a chance on one of the NYRB's reissues. That's a tongue twister, actually.
Nerb.
Yeah, if it intrigues you in the least, you can't go wrong. Now they've entered the digital age with the NYRB planning about a dozen digital-only releases in the coming year beyond what they've already, they're tackling all these other titles in print. First up is the Water Theater by Lindsay Clark. It shows the topsy-turvy world publishing has become when a book like the Water Theater, needs to be rescued. Clark is an award-winning UK writer, and the Times of London named it one of the best books of the year. Other titles in the series have sold hundreds of thousands of copies in their home country, but couldn't get any love from U.S. publishers. Any titles that get traction as ebooks will get a physical edition as well. The NYRB says while speed isn't of the essence, thanks to e-publishing, they can move quicker, get books out faster, and for a much lower cost. So taking a chance on these titles isn't really all that expensive. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? Can we move on to the next one? Because I know it's a big deal.
It's a fascinating deal. I'll say that. It's fascinating. It shows how much ebooks are upending the publishing industry. They said, oh, you really shouldn't get, you should be able to, shouldn't pay so much less for ebooks because they're not, it costs us a lot to put them out. Malarkey. It does not cost them nearly as much to put out an ebook as it does a physical book. And the positives of it are stuff like this, where books around the world that get curated by a label you trust, like the New York Review of Books, they say, hey, we're not ready to put these books out physically, but they're terrific books. They should be available. We've got the digital file right here. It takes them nothing really to make them available and say, hey, let's put them out there and show discrimination. Not going to put out thousands of books, but they say, hey, you trust us. Here are some really good books. We'll make them available ebook only. If they catch on fire, we'll put out a print edition as well. But nonetheless, they're going to be available in the U.S. market and people can catch them and read them. I've already got gallons of these four books that they're putting out on my Kindle because I'm a reviewer. So I'm very excited. I think it really shows how much more savvy and smart and how much more books can become available perpetually to people all over the world that ebooks are making possible. So it's the low cost of entry, the ability to have somebody that you trust, like the New York Review of Books, curate it and say, hey, here's 10 or 15 or 20 books we really think you want to pay attention to.
Wait a second. Were you just bragging there? Were you just like...
No, I'm not bragging. I'm saying, look at that. I mean, they announced those books. I went online and said, oh, look, I'm already able to get these books and read them and say to people, hey, The Water Theater is terrific. You need to read it or recommend one of the other books. It's just the speed of which they can decide to put a book out, make a gala available to reviewers, and we can get it out to the world and get the word out. It's just it moves at warp speed where the publishing industry, normally, if they announced a book today, it would come out about 12 or 14 months from now.
You know what doesn't move at warp speed?
What?
If you happen to be waiting for a check from a series that aired in the 70s, the 60s, the 80s, you can wait a long time. Just ask Glenn Larson, who is he's a really wildly successful producer of the hit TV shows like $6 Million Man and Magnum P.I. He's suing Universal over profits from another one of his hit shows, Knight Rider. And you might remember this was the silly show about the man and a talking car, which I loved. I don't know why anybody would call it silly. Oh. And everybody knows, you don't talk to your car, you talk to your phone. Hello, Siri. Larson says the show has grossed hundreds of millions of dollars, and he doesn't receive any profit participation statements. And as the years go on, somehow the deficit on the show grows bigger and bigger and bigger, rather than smaller and smaller and smaller. Universal moved to have the case dismissed and failed last week. You know, of course, you know, this piddly little case, of course there's no money. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because every single day in the Hollywood Reporter or somewhere else, you read about a new lawsuit. You cannot trust these companies whatsoever. It's everybody. I mean, this guy's a big power player. He would have had the best lawyers, the best people around him. He must have good accountants and people still today. I'm sure he's, you know, wealthy and doing well. Why wasn't he speaking up before we didn't get a profit participation statement? This is what I don't understand.
Well, sometimes
case after
because
case, people say, hey, we haven't got a profit participation statement in 20 years. To which I say, well, where the hell was your lawyer or your accountant?
Well, and but, very often the lawyers are saying, well, I'll just give them another month or give them another quarter or give them
years.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, I think, you know, after 1 year.
But it's amazing. Even people who are rich and powerful and are savvy have to fight tooth and nail to get the money that they're owed from these studios. Can't trust them worth a damn.
Well, I think maybe for television, they might need to have something like SoundScan. And maybe they do. I'll have to look into that. I'll call Jonathan Handel, who the lawyer that is often on our show as a guest.
Yeah, we need a lawyer on constant retainer just to cover all the lawsuits that we cover.
That's true. Which, you know, a lot of those lawsuits are kind of very insidery, almost like inside baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they will affect you. And this week, I'm going to turn it over to Michael because he's going to tell me how Nielsen, you know, that group that does the ratings here in the U.S. and apparently all over the world, they're being sued by India's largest television network for, well, Michael, why don't you explain what it's for? Because I've always kind of thought this was going on, at least here in North America.
Oh, you assumed it was going on in North America, too?
Yes.
Wow. Well, this company, NDTV, it's the largest TV network in India. They are alleging that Nielsen's ratings in India have been manipulated for years, that they have not accurately reflected the ratings, and that Nielsen knew it. And Nielsen and its partners in India have accepted bribes to manipulate the ratings, used a sample size that was way too small, which means it was all the easier to fiddle with the ratings, and that they've been doing this for a long, long time. They're suing for more than $1 billion. really interestingly, they say similar practices take place all over the world, including Turkey, the Philippines, and Florida.
Florida, the country of Florida.
Out of all things, but apparently in Florida, all those old people are taking bribes to say they're watching shows that they're not.
I should qualify what I said earlier. I don't think that anybody in the U.S. from Nielsen is taking bribes or giving bribes or whatever. I think that the sample is too small.
Oh, no question. The sample is too small. Here's some of the details. It was a 194-page lawsuit, which is probably timid by lawsuit standards. And 194 pages isn't that big, I guess. It was filed in New York court last week. I don't know why that was the venue that they used, but it is. NDTV accuses Nielsen of violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Ah, that's why they filed in America, because they claim Nielsen is breaking its own laws in its own country. And they say they're manipulating viewership data in favor of channels that are willing to provide bribes. They say that there are private equity firms that own Nielsen right now, and those companies have been demanding Nielsen cut their costs to the bone while they get ready to sell it off. They want to make as much profit as possible before they sell Nielsen off to somebody, and they don't want to have ratings slip, of course, or earnings, I should say, but they do want them to cut costs because they don't want to spend a lot of money while they're waiting to sell it. I don't know how NDTV would know this, but that's what they say that they're doing. They say that in India, Nielsen has about 8,000 households wired up to people meters to provide the ratings for Nielsen. That's in a country that has 1 billion people.
Yeah, I mean, right now, half the country of India, the eastern half, I think,
is out of power.
Yeah, they have no power. That represents 600 million individuals, 600 million people, more than live in the entire EU.
Wow, without power.
Yes, correct.
And only 4,000 of them have people meters, apparently. So if you're trying to figure out what those 600 million people are watching, there are only 4,000 homes.
No, I thought it was 8,000 households.
Well, there's 8,000 total, but if you're talking about half the country, it would be 4,000.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, we don't know where they're located physically. Of course, they could all be in Delhi. You know, who knows? But the point is, when you have that small a sample size, and we saw this in a story about, was it CNBC? CNBC had this bizarre drop in ratings, and people couldn't figure out what was going on. CNBC plummeted in the ratings, and they could, what's going on here?
And Nickelodeon as well.
And they figured out that, well, in this particular case, they figured out one person had gone from age 49 to age 50. And because the sample of people watching CNBC was so small in Nielsen households, that one guy meant like a 10, 15, 20% drop in ratings. I mean, that's how crazy it is. You've got to have a bigger sample size.
I couldn't agree more. I think that in a day and age when your web analytics is, you know, you can track every user and say, well, we had 18 million visitors on this day or 20 million on the other day. And then you're basically going, well, it's about roughly 40 million people watched because we don't really know, but we think it's somewhere around. I mean, you could, with all of those cable set-top boxes, get it right down to who is watching what when.
And you could get a big, broad sample. You would know what TVs were on, what shows were watched, what shows were taped and watched within an hour of that day or the next day. You wouldn't know how many people were sitting in front of the TV.
That's
true. You wouldn't know how many people were at a bar. There could be 100 people watching a sports program, and that's a big, long-time complaint that colleges and bars and public places show television events, and they miss millions of people for those things. But, you know, this is part – put aside the fact of whether the sample is good enough and accurate enough, and part of the case is that NDTV says they knew it wasn't a big enough sample. They say even the sample that was there was not legal and proper anyway. They said there's lots of corruption with people meter. They say that networks track down the homes – who have people meters, and they pay them to watch certain shows. They install a second TV so people can watch what they want, and you have the official people meter TV turned to certain channels at times of the day. They use the button that says, oh, there's 4 or 5 guests watching this show. They abuse that to pretend there's 10 or 20 people watching the shows all the time, doing all these sort of things illegally just to manipulate the small sample size that's already there. And they say Nielsen knew about all of this. Of course, he says. They're taking bribes.
Wait, in India?
NDTV says that they met with Nielsen. They've talked to Nielsen. Nielsen says we're gonna bump up the sample size.
Wait, there's corruption and bribery in India?
There's corruption and
I'm
bribery
shocked
in America
they're gambling
too.
Here.
In America too, all over the world.
Yeah.
But I'm shocked that they say Nielsen knew about it. And they say they met with Nielsen, and Nielsen, told them that yes, there was a serious possibility that these allegations of corruption were true. They said they seized the laptops of some of the officials that they believed in their subsidiary, or however that company in India is designated. They seized their laptops and took them back to the U.S. for forensic analysis, and yet they did nothing about it.
Which is another way of saying, we brought them back to the United States to hide the evidence.
That's possible. Now, Nielsen operates in more than 100 countries. and they earn more than $5 billion a year. And they've had trouble in other countries. Like in Ireland, they tried to set up the rating service, and people were mocking the results that they were coming up with, saying that they're not doing a good enough job. They don't want to spend the money to put people meters in a lot of homes to get a much bigger sample, and yet they want to claim that their sampling is accurate. So they have problems just on the scientific level. I think it's interesting that they would say—
Scientific, or really the technology is the issue.
Right. And I think it's interesting that they would say that they could sue over the fact that they were knowingly not using a scientifically proper sample. I mean, Nielsen would say, hey, this is, we didn't hide what we were doing. People know that in America, there are about 130 million households, and we've got 25,000 people meters installed. That's the sample size that we use in America. Never mind that there are, you know, cable boxes and DVR and smart set-top boxes in like 90 million homes or something like that. You know, never mind that you should be able to use that and get raw data without tracking it to people and be able to say, hey, at least we have a good idea what's going on. No, they say we got 25,000 households. Everybody knows that. So, you know, it's not our fault if you don't think it's accurate enough. That's what we use and what we say. And the fact that you don't think it's good enough, well, tough.
Well, here in the U.S., 128 million households. That's about our listenership here at Showbiz Sandbox, because they all go to iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher to subscribe to us.
Yes. So it's interesting. How does this affect us? Well, it could affect us. Nielsen could take a big hit at the stock market. They could be forced to do a better job in North America. We could start to get more accurate ratings. I don't know why these cable companies and these people don't band together to take raw data and provide a much better sample of what people are actually doing. We already see them getting sampling of DVR usage 1 day, 3 day, 7 day. So we're already getting a better look at what people do, but there's no reason to limit to 25,000 households. You know, I don't want to sit there and fill out a diary, a paper diary.
No, I don't
want people tracking what I personally use, but I know that there's raw data that they have of what I'm doing. And why not put all that raw data together, aggregate it, and just break it out and say, all right, in this household where there's one person living, guess what? If the TV's on, it's probably me, the 46-year-old guy watching the TV. So, you know, you can get really good information about what shows and who's watching, and it should be a lot more accurate than what it is now.
I can't believe you let me get away with an in-house plug in the middle of your I'll call it a tirade against Nielsen.
Tirade? Thoughtful commentary?
That's the word I was looking for. Thoughtful commentary. Yes.
What if readers want to send us their thoughtful commentary?
Well, actually, it's funny you should mention that, because we do have an email address, which is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And if you want us to hear your voices, you can call us at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And we'll read some of your emails and play some of your voicemails on future episodes. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find, of course, the ways to contact us, the ways to subscribe, as I mentioned, iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher. Please do subscribe to the show and rate and review it on those aggregators. You can also sign up for an email. Every time we post a new episode, we'll send you an email. That's also where you'll find those ways to follow us on Twitter. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox on Facebook. Our page can be found under Showbiz Sandbox. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has a website where some of his writing can be found, including some of those book reviews. It is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Showbiz Sandbox, where you get 90 minutes of news. You get all the week's news in 90 minutes or more.